mein auf den Supercast.
Hello and welcome to the 20 Megabyte Doctor Who podcast, episode 376. I'm Adam, and I couldn't be bothered to do a quote this week, and here's Debbie Melrose.
This is lovely salami, thank you.
Mary Lang.
I speak a pretty good English.
Kirby Bartlett Sloan.
I am not a number, not that. No, I ain't going in there, Giovanni.
Great quote, that wasn't. Yes, this week we're looking at The Mask of Mandragora, or as Debbie calls it...
Mandragora, because I can't say it properly.
Well, that's what I used to call it. But
you say it properly quite a lot of times, yeah. Actually. Yes, and it's a story the podcast has looked at previously, but I'm going to forget that. We're just going to review it as a new thing. I beg your pardon?
You've never seen it? No, not seen this one.
Okay, right.
Well, I have now, but I've not seen it before.
So let's get on then. Well,
and I've totally forgotten that we looked at it before. I don't remember any of it.
It's not memorable.
Yeah. Well, it was, what, 4 or 5 years ago we looked at it.
Terry and Miles has reacted to the video with a wow face. I don't know. That's probably just looking at me, I would imagine. Cheers, Terry.
Sat in the corner. Oh, yeah, there he is.
Right. So it starts with the Doctor and Sarah Jane wandering through the white corridors of the TARDIS, probably for one of the last times for a year or so, and stumbling across an old mahogany style... yeah, apart from the boot cupboard, yeah. Which, oh, it's enormous! That's what she said. yeah, and stumbling across an old mahogany-style TARDIS console room festooned with little... tidbits of previous Doctors, like the Third Doctor's dusty, frilly thing. Even though we never saw the Third Doctor in this room. I beg your pardon, Mary?
I wondered about all the dust.
Yeah.
I mean, nothing else in there is dusty.
Well, no.
And is there actually dust in the TARDIS?
That did strike me as a bit odd.
Yeah.
There is now.
Apparently there is. Huh?
Yes. Anyway, the Doctor takes out the pink shirt from the costume. Also, on top of the console is a shaving mirror and a recorder, which Sarah starts playing. Of course, I did put on the 20 Megabyte Doctor Who podcast Facebook group, which you can join, a picture of this recorder, which Kirby was very quickly showing me that a similar recorder has appeared with the Second Doctor.
Yes.
Previously, anyway, so good.
Yeah, he used the striped one a couple of times, but he also used the plain one.
Well, I'm glad he used the plain one because that makes it a bit more sort of consistent. So the Doctor finds the TARDIS.
What are those things, Master?
What?
What are those things hanging off of the railing in front of the console? They almost look like headphones.
Can't see what you're talking about. Sorry.
Okay, right when they see the helix and they're bouncing up and down.
They look like either headphones or earmuffs, or earmuffs, those sound reducing type things, perhaps.
I wonder if that's a mistake.
Well, you think it's floor manager's kit, do you?
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, right. So, like you say, they see this sort of load of paint with some polystyrene balls going around in circles, and
they get distorted in the little mirror,
yes,
Miralax thing,
and then land in some nowhere sort of place with a load of crystals, and all this shenanigans allows the Mandragora sort of energy to go into the TARDIS. Meanwhile, on Earth,
Master.
Oh, good grief.
This is a completely reconstructed TARDIS. This is the second one that they made because the first one happened to fall apart at the end of the last season, part of it falling on Liz Sladen's head.
Okay.
So we have a new TARDIS.
Okay. Yay. Right. So, so meanwhile on Earth, some bloke dies. So they hail the new prince, I suppose. Is he a prince? Can't remember now.
He's a Duke.
And, of course, there's a load of stuff going on, political stuff going on in this dukedom, which reminded me a little bit of Merlin. Merlin's a TV program that the BBC produced in the noughties or noughties and
yeah. Come years. To think of it, it is very Merlin-like.
It's all this uncles against nephews and stuff like that, which was going on in Merlin. But there you go.
Sir Tim Piggott Smith,
who only died, last year, or was it this year?
Last year.
Is that how the name is pronounced? Is Piggott?
No, Piggott.
Piggott Smith.
I mean, and this is his early days before he becomes irregular as a despicable villain time and time again.
Did he? I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
Villain? Oh, okay. I don't know. This is the only place I've seen him.
He has been in another Doctor Who.
He's in a lot of BBC productions.
Oh, in BBC productions, yeah. He was in Johnny English, the second Johnny English film, I think.
Oh.
And also, I'm looking forward to the third one of those. And more recently, more topical to us, his last film was Victoria and Abdul, filmed here on the Isle of Wight.
I didn't know that was filmed there.
I beg your pardon?
I didn't know that was filmed there. I need to watch it.
Right, what we're going to do there, Debbie, what do you think we're going to do after that comment?
I think there might be an
Oh, dear. Osborne House is on the Isle of Wight, and you didn't know that Victoria and Abdul was filmed on the Isle. That's absurd. I'm sorry.
We talked about it. He must have.
Yeah, he's just deliberately getting points to that, I reckon.
No, I didn't. I'm sorry.
That's absurd.
Tim was a major character in an ongoing BBC production called The Jewel and the Crown.
That's right, yeah, it was a classical series, Jordan.
Oh, okay, principal photography on the film. Okay, yes, it's coming back now.
It's coming back now, is it? Still get the point deducted.
At Osborne House, okay.
Now, the other thing you get the point deducted for is the fact that I now have to load up my scores page and actually implement that particular point deduction. Bear with.
Thank you, sir. May I lose another?
You probably will.
If it's not Doctor Who related, do you think he should lose a point?
No. Yes, sorry. Yes, I do.
It's Doctor Who related because the Victoria knighted the Doctor, remember?
Well, thanks for backing yourself up. You could have got the point. Reinstated him. No, it's not to do with being Doctor Who. It's to do with him allegedly knowing everything and knowing the Victoria and Abdul. Right, I might give you a point back. Where did Queen Victoria die? What's your name again? Kirby, isn't it? Where did Queen Victoria die?
I'm going to guess Isle of Wight.
Oh, no, that's not close enough. So you keep your point deducted. Go on in, Debbie. What was the answer?
I think it was in her room in Osborne House.
It was in her room in Osborne House. Anyway, so it's Kirby's still on minus one. Right. Back to the episodes. Yeah, so we're just...
asking Americans.
It's Kirby. It's not specifically the American thing. I don't expect you to know, Mary. But
okay.
The amount of times I've posted on Facebook pictures of myself and my family at Osborne House, which was quite clearly the backdrop to Victoria and Abdul, and mentioned on several occasions, not least mentioning the fact that I met Eddie Izzard in the shop while they were filming it, and that was a big enough hint to show that Victoria and Abdul... which was the film I was referring to. There's so many reasons.
I quite a bit after recording sometimes.
I'm being generous. Yeah. I really should be good 10 points deducted for that. Right. So, yeah, we meet a few of these.
Laurie Nix is now telling me that I'm not a Queen Victoria scholar.
Right. So, yeah, we meet a few of these characters very quickly. That's... Federico and his uncle and Hieronymus and Mark
Polo.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say that. Then eventually, after meeting all these characters, the Doctor and Sarah arrive in the orange sort of an orange farm. No, what's an orange version of an orchard?
Grove.
It's a grove.
And then while they're sneaking around, the Mandragora Helix escapes the TARDIS and. Some people try to walk off with Sarah, which upsets her daughter a little bit, actually. Yeah. Tells them to put her down. And Then Hieronymus decides. Well, sorry, not sorry. The uncle. What's the uncle? What's his name? Anybody? The uncle's name?
The uncle is Federico, isn't
it? Yeah, Federico.
Is it? Yeah.
Right, he tells Hieronymus that he must now come up with a brilliant prediction that the young duke himself must now die, so as he can kill him and make it look like the stars have aligned in that particular way. So the doctor meanwhile has a few.
And of course they have.
Yeah, the doctor meanwhile has a few little tete-a-tetes with various people. And
isn't one of these peasants Stuart Fell in the first
Stuart
of
Fell.
Several times?
Stuart Fell is in this particular story a few times. He more notably as the
entertainer at the end.
Yeah, he's not called an entertainer though, is he, Debbie? He's a jester. That's right. Well done.
He's credited as an entertainer.
Well, I'm going to call it the jester, and you've got to be careful,
he
Kirby.
He tries to steal the scene, doesn't he?
He does.
Hey.
So the doctor obviously has a conversation with Federico, and a very amusing one at that. And then Sarah gets dressed in a white costume because it has to be white because obviously with the blood and stuff, because she's going to get sacrificed. The doctor meanwhile has been sentenced to death and gets sort of readied for his execution.
Goes up on the same balcony that Number Two used many, many times.
Number Two?
The prisoner.
Okay, thank you. And while he's
You still haven't watched The Prisoner?
No, and I won't either. While he's... Hi. Shut up!
You've got to try it.
It's excellent.
Be quiet. By being
I sent you a link to...
Right, that's it. Three be quiets means...
Thank you, sir. May I lose another?
Nope. And 1 point for Mary, for Debbie, for agreeing with Kirby. Right then. So where do we get up to? All right. So like I say, one of the people holding on to the doctor is, of course, Stuart Fell, as we've just mentioned. He swings the sword after getting signaled to do so, but the doctor gets out of it by rather bizarrely being allowed to take his scarf off and then hooking it around the executioner's ankles.
Excuse me, I just want to get comfortable.
Yeah. Yes. And he legs it.
That isn't what I thought would happen. And I mean, does that really make sense that scarf could actually do that?
Well, I tripped over my scarf many occasion.
You trip people up?
I tripped over my own scarf. So if I can trip over it, other people can trip over it. And the worst thing being, of course, when I shut the car door and the scarf was hanging out the car door and somebody stopped me and said, "You're going to choke yourself to death."
Yeah.
Master.
What?
I'm looking at I'm watching a lot of these scenes of the doctor running around the village.
Yes.
And it's interesting now, if you look online and try and spot some of these same places, because there's so many pictures of Port Mirian?
That sounds right.
There's so many pictures online. You could not film this nowadays because most of those staircases have banisters.
Well, there you go. Right then, on the live feed, Laurie Nick says, "Woohoo." Lillian Robin says, "Yay, I made it in time." Jason Chuang says, "I will only be here briefly. Just wanted to say hello to everyone. Hope you are all doing well." I've got a very bad knee, actually, Jason. It's really giving me jip. Laurie Nick says, "Boot cupboard." And then... what do you think? I'm Philip Schofield. He's got grey hair. I haven't got anything. And then Laurie Nick says, "Oh, Kirby, not a Queen Victoria scholar." Alan T. Butcher says, "The jester, Stuart Fell, didn't fall. He tumbled it, actually, didn't he?" And then Jason Chuang says, "Kirby is talking too much." Yes. And then Alan T. Butcher says, "Kirby too much? Never," sarcastically.
Thank you, Alan.
Is it possible to give points to people that are not on the podcast?
It should be, shouldn't it? But it's not. Right, so... Anyway, Hieronymus, right then. So, the doctor follows Hieronymus, or we didn't know it was Hieronymus because he had the mask on at this point, down to where Sarah is just about to be sacrificed. And while
I love how when Hieronymus takes the mask off, in the times that you can see his face, he has to straighten that stupid beard out into the two little tufts.
Yeah. Anyway, so during their sort of dramatic stuff, the Doctor sneaks Sarah away, and they find a body which is a strange sort of blue colour with a really terrible beetle wig sort of attached to it.
Yes.
This body obviously been attacked by Mandragora.
Well, they had the body earlier in there. It's the guy who was straightening out all the straw, but who got killed by the Mandragora.
Yes.
Helix.
Yes. Anyway, so yes. Moving on, the Doctor sort of now is in league with the Duke and his little sidekicks, but they were a bit suspicious of him to start off with, and sorry, I'm just moving on a little bit. There's lots of political stuff going on.
Marco Polo.
Yeah, and then we see that somebody in 12th Doctor cosplay, who turns out to be the sidekick of Hieronymus. And the Doctor has a point in which realizes that he's bought this upon them because he's allowed the Mandragora Helix to arrive on Earth through bringing it in the TARDIS. So they sort of head off down to the catacombs, and a load of soldiers turn up.
Where the bat droppings are twice as high as your head or something like that.
Something like that. And there's a point in which what was the name of the young Duke? I can't remember his name.
Juliana
takes a shine to Sarah Jane.
Oh, quite a shine. He's holding her hand and everything.
The old lech. Yeah. I'm very fond of you, Juliano.
And the thing is that you kind of get this feeling in some of the other scenes that Juliano is
interested in Marco.
A little more than best buds with Marco. Oh,
yeah, I think he's more interested.
Yeah.
I mean, the way he sits there and talks to Sarah Jane, it's like, you know, the student to a teacher he's trying to impress.
Yeah, there's a bit of something going on there, which something unmentionable, but I do hope they meant to do that because that was quite clever. Obviously, the BBC in the 1970s would never have been allowed to actually show something like that in a programme that goes out on air the same time as Doctor Who did. But it would be nice to think that that's actually what they were trying to imply, but very sort of cunningly.
Yes.
Back to the feed.
I had that impression even when I saw this in 1980.
Did you?
Yeah.
Hmm. What did you have that impression, Debbie?
I was very hopeful for them and hope they have a good future together, to be honest.
Right.
Each to their own.
John Davey, friend of the show, has just posted, "Hey there, I'll try not to crash the podcast this week." John, you were actually supposed to be on the podcast last week. But never mind. And then Laurie Nick says, "Yay, John's back." And yay, John's so far so good. Right.
Jason says everyone should get bonus points except for Adam.
Jason will get points deducted next time he plays the frizz. Right, so back in the catacombs. The Doctor, something happens. I don't know if it's a loud noise or something, but the Doctor didn't like it. He held his hands to his ears. And then there's a little battle goes on between the soldiers
I couldn't figure that out. What was it that was going on that made him do that? Just
the sound.
Just
I think it's the sound of the Mandragora energy, I think.
I guess.
Yeah. And then there's a little battle goes on between the Federico's soldiers and Giuliano's friends.
And no one loses any wigs.
Nobody knew, and the Doctor is absolutely loving this swashbuckling thing, and he's great big smile on his face as he swings a girt sword. Really enjoying. He's quite the last couple of stories actually been quite action packed, doesn't he?
Yes.
And
I know he's carrying on the Third Doctor's mission,
but definitely do it in the Fourth Doctor styley. By the way, during this little battle, Giuliano gets a little nick.
Oh yeah.
And the Doctor gives him a bit of first aid, but Sarah has been kidnapped during the scuffle.
First aid. Did you notice he brings out the magic handkerchief?
Yeah, yes, but it's not wet though.
All we needed was a little water,
a bit of magic water. That'll do it.
Yeah. John Davey says, "Yay too. Sorry I couldn't make it last week. Too much work." Well, you can come on now if you like, John. Moving on. Yeah, so Sarah gets kidnapped by the...
Andy is watching. It says he? Andy is watching.
Andy's a naughty boy. But yeah, we knew that. We didn't know.
Why isn't he on?
He's a very naughty boy. Yeah, so Sarah gets kidnapped, as I was trying to allude to, by the Mandragorans, or what would you call them, Debbie?
Mandragorans?
Mandragorans,
yes.
Mandragorans.
Surely the Gorans are something completely different. Oh, God, what now? Yes?
We'd find a way.
They are the Cult of Demnos.
Oh, Mando. Dear. Okay, they're the Cult of Demnos.
Demnos.
Yes. Yes. Just so Kirby could say it.
They were that before the Mandragoran.
Okay, they're right. For me, they're the Mandragorans. Even if they are the Cult of Demnos, essentially they're controlled by this Mandragoran Helix dude. I think. So pedantic. Right then. So Sarah, meanwhile, gets
some. That's what you pay me for.
No, I don't. Gets hypnotized into the task of killing the Doctor. And which of course enables Elizabeth Sladen to do what she does best, possessed acting.
Yay.
And it's a bit of it's her last two stories. There's plenty of possessed acting for her to do in both of them, which is fantastic. Mm-hmm. So the Doctor is led deliberately to find the passed out Sarah in the catacombs with Giuliano and. Yeah, so they take her back somewhere, and at the first opportunity she gets, she has a poisoned needle which she's going to attack the Doctor with. But when she does, the Doctor says, "You're my friend, you're my best friend. Why would you want to do that sort of thing?" And
I like that.
Yeah, he snaps her out of it really quickly.
Followed by the guards grabbing the Doctor. So if she drops that thing, I mean. Frederica could have picked it up, or Hieronymus could have picked it up and scratched him with it. Anybody could have got the Doctor with it.
Yeah, there's just a needle now lying around, heavy with poison.
Yeah, just laying on the floor. Nobody's doing anything.
You can tell you two are mothers, can't you? Great.
But if it just takes a scratch, why don't you have Hieronymus scratch him with it?
We're just concerned about the
clearly, yes. I rest my case. Anyway, when of course there's some great sort of I realise what I'm doing acting by Elizabeth Sladen when of course she snapped out of her, you know, her thing. Meanwhile, Federico's men have captured Tim Piggott Smith's. I can't remember. I mean, all these names, I never get their names right.
You know what?
We'll call it Tim Piggott. What?
I don't know if. Dr. Phil's going to mention it, but a lot of the minor characters' names are simply names of Italian composers. Rossini. And
yes,
stuff.
Very good. And Leon Robin says, "'Tis a bit of a scratch." Is Magic sat in the corner scratching over there? No, he isn't.
She says, "'Tis but a scratch."
As yeah, unfortunately, I'm still not used to these varifocals. If I looked slightly to the right, I can't read that. I have to turn my head and move into the screen to actually read
that.
You
would have picked that up straight away, being a Python fan.
Be quite right. Point deducted for Debbie for being
Python. Hey! I'm on a roll!
who can irritate Master more?
Shut up. Anyway, so... yeah, so Tim Piggott Smith's been he's being tortured by Federico. I can't remember what information he's trying to get out of him, and then with this he's trying to
make him say that Giuliano is part of the Cult of Demnos.
Oh, point reinstated for Debbie for helping me out. Yeah, so the Doctor meanwhile then gets caught and then is sort of threatened by Federico, and there's a lovely scene in which the Doctor tells Federico do you expect me to believe you, and he said, well, no, I don't expect you to believe me, but if you don't do this and this, then well, you're all going to die essentially. And
Master,
yes,
one thing I like down in the catacombs around the altar, they have this very theatrical thing where they're projecting those images onto pieces of cloth.
Oh yes,
it's really neat. I love it.
Oh yeah, the bit where it all lights up one by one.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Very good stuff. So everybody's been caught by the end of episode three. There's Giuliano's sort of strapped up against the wall, and then...
And you get caught.
The doctor tells Federico not to go and challenge...
Hey, what's your name?
The doctor tells Federico not to go and challenge Hieronymus, because he'll probably end up dead. So what's he going to do? He goes and challenges him and ends up dead. And there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of stuff that reminded me slightly of the demons, where they're all sort of doing their sacrificial stuff in their of gowns and stuff. The doctor and everybody gets released.
And then there's the from out of nowhere dance.
Yeah. Nope. They have that in musicals all the time. Yes, Isabella.
Dance like the sisters did.
I mean, all of a sudden, everyone's gathered for this dance. Just they happen to throw anyway.
No. Here we are. We have Isabella Pearson here, who's now going to do a very short mention of what she thought of the what's that film called again? What was the film called?
I don't even know the name.
Avengers Infinity War. Yeah, go on and tell me what. Don't give any spoilers. What did you think of it?
I loved it.
There you go. Goodbye, Isabella. That's fantastic. That's Isabella's review of Avengers Infinity War. Yeah, goodbye. I will tell you that we got into a bit of a disagreement.
Thank you for coming yesterday, Isabella.
She's not here. We got into a bit of a disagreement yesterday, because on the way home, I said, well, because they might as well bring in Batman and Wonder Woman. And she said, that's DC, not Marvel. I said, well, Disney seem to be buying out everything. It won't be very long before they've bought out DC, and they'll own everything and merge everything, and we will get the crossover stuff. But anyway, and she said that will not happen, and that she then didn't speak to me for the rest of the night. In fact, when I got home from work today, I was told I still wasn't forgiven for what I said. Okay.
Okay.
But I'm waiting for the moment that actually does happen, so I can say, told you so. If it's going to make money, they're going to do it. Simple as that. Right then, so she was. Then her argument was that that Marvel makes loads of money, and DC makes just loads of money. So there's no competition.
DC, the thing DC does not make is good movies.
Yeah, well, there you go then.
That's true.
I think Wonder Woman was a very good film. Thank you very much.
They made one.
Yeah. Wonder Woman.
Done.
Anyway, so they decide, back to the story, they decide to have a mask so that Giuliano can have a bit of entertainment.
We can reuse some of the cast and actors from previous episodes without knowing who they are.
Oh, yes, indeed.
And we can see Stuart Fell showing off.
Yeah, that's another reason, yes. Meanwhile, there's slightly a distraction, so the doctor could implement his plan of getting some wire and basically earthing out the Mandragora Helix.
It seemed a rather easy way of finishing it off.
Well, there's a bit of that and a bit of the reference to, a sort of back future reference to, what's that film I like so much? Back to the Future 3, where Marty McFly wears the
bulletproof vest.
Yeah. So there's a bit of that going on. And, so he basically, his plan comes to fruition perfectly, but we didn't think that had happened at one point when, obviously, Sarah approaches what she thinks is a doctor in his lion mask. It turns out the doctor's actually wearing Hieronymus's...
It turns out, Master?
Yep.
It turns out the guy wearing the lion mask was Lion.
How long were you waiting to do that?
Thank you, sir.
I suppose that's quite a good point reinstated for Kirby. I quite like that one. I don't know what's the matter with me. I must be going soft. Dibby's got to be a minus two, so I just change that around. Right then, so... after earthing out the Mandragora Helix, the Doctor and Sarah go on their way with one last bit of flirting for Giuliano with Sarah, and that's it. That's the end of the story. So the Mask of Mandragora is a thoroughly enjoyable little sort of classical romp. Not a lot of times that we actually get to Doctor Who in this day and age to go back to a specific period in time and just sort of be there and there be sci-fi references and stuff. But this was done very well because it's a BBC costume drama, and obviously BBCs and costumes go very, very well. Some great actors in this story. Some fun in it. I think it paces quite well. Don't think there's much filling going on. Although, obviously, I did skip back past quite a few conversations because they were, you know, superfluous to this particular review. But on the whole, I think this is a really, really good story. And it makes me slightly sad that this is the last story that Sarah sort of goes off with the Doctor at the end of the story. But it's a charming little tale. And Tom Baker is fantastic in it, very funny. And it's quite melodramatic in some ways as well, which I quite enjoy. And it's basically got your typical villain in Hieronymus, who could well have been the Master in some ways as well. So, yeah, I really, really enjoyed Mask of Mandragora. What did you think of it, Kirby?
I love this story. Of course, I love the Hinchcliffe era because basically it was the first Doctor Who I ever saw was all right in this period. It's fun. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I had already, by the time I saw this in 1980, I had seen The Prisoner. And so I'm going, whoa, this is great. They've got it set at the village. It's just fun. Not much more I can say.
That's pretty good for you, really, and the fact that you actually managed to make it concise. Right. Hang on, I've got something coming through on the feed. What we got? We've got Laurie Nick says, I agree with Isabella. And then Lillian Robin says, I agree with Isabella. Did you copy it? Did you two copy and paste that?
And that's what we're doing this for, to listen to Isabella.
Yeah, so I'll tell you what may happen during this recording is the co-founder of the show may indeed come through that door to my right, where the GARM is currently panting. Because she's coming home from the gym, so there might be a glimpse of the co-founder of the show. She probably won't say much
How
on the show.
How long staying at yours?
Would you call me?
How long she's staying at yours?
I don't know. As long as a piece of string may be.
Fair enough.
I do not know. her tenancy agreement, which she still hasn't signed yet, says 1 year. But hopefully it won't be quite as long as that. Yes, Laurie Nick says, not that Disney won't ever buy DC, that the Avengers was epic. That the Avengers is epic. Oh, not that Disney won't ever buy DC, that the Avengers is epic. Yeah, that's what she says anyway. Thanks, Laurie. Right then, so who am I asking next? Have you seen this before, Debbie?
No.
Right then, go on then, what do you think?
I haven't seen it.
You donut. What do you think of the story?
Quite Shakespearean.
Oh.
As in Hamlet-ish. Yes. Yeah, with the the evil uncle. For a minute, I thought we were watching Richard III when we first opened, I must say, because with hairstyle and everything.
I was a bit off, yeah.
There we go. Here we go again. I'm a Ricardian, so I don't like the way he's portrayed in that anyway, but by the by. Ooh. And, I kind of had to binge watch it briefly, and then I watched it again, and I was like, I'm not sure I'm really into this as much as people are probably expecting me to be into this, because I love my historicals. I really love it when we do actually go back to an actual time, you know, like we did a lot in the first series, and I miss that. I miss the fact that it was originally designed to be like a history show, you know, and it was nice to sort of touch base with its roots a couple of times, especially
or a science show.
Exactly, you know, it's just it's great to touch base with it, but I felt that there was an awful lot of running about again and being captured and not captured, captured, not captured, which is great, but it's becoming a little bit formulaic for this era. And
Debbie,
yeah,
this is Doctor Who.
I know.
But it doesn't mean she has to like it.
But I didn't. Last week's I had, I wasn't too sure about. And this week as well, unfortunately, this wasn't. I can see why Mary didn't remember it, because it was a lot of running around in the woods and running around in the catacombs. The story idea was sound and good, but I think it was a lot. I know it was only four episodes on, but I think it was too long.
That's what you said.
It was like a filler story. So I'm sorry I'm being controversial again. And I'm,
no! You're just being mean, Debbie.
No. I'm sort of on the fence with it, I'm afraid. I'm sorry.
It's quite funny, really, because now you've said that, we sort of know what's going to happen next, don't we, Mary?
Well, I'm going to kind of expand on what Debbie said, because I'm kind of in the boat with her.
What a surprise.
It's gorgeous to look at. It's
that's what she said.
It's wonderful to listen to. I did read the comment that when the BBC does anything historical, it is perfection down to the walk-on costumes. You know, and every little thing in the scene is perfect to a period. But then when the BBC does science fiction, they just put everybody in silver zip suits and hand them sticks with flashing lights on the ends. And that is... That is so true here. it is. It's lovely to look at, and I had enjoyed the scenery and the costumes, and the acting really is very good. I enjoyed Tom Baker's craziness in this because he does act crazy a lot. And I also read that Philip Hinchcliffe decided with this new season 14, that he was wanting to get away from where the show had been going. He wanted to get away from UNIT. He wanted to get away from, the invasions, monster invasions of Earth, new monster every week. So this was supposed to set the new tone. Well, there isn't a whole lot that we haven't already seen. I mean, here we have another cult, people worshiping something they don't understand. Down to the little, we were talking about the little twirly dances around the altar, like the Sisters of Karn were doing. We still have, something invading from outer Earth. We have Liz Slayton, as we earlier commented, getting, hypnotized yet again. So there just was, and another main character falling in love with the Doctor's companion. So they didn't get very far away from, things that they had been doing. But just a few observations here that I found it amusing that Marco down in the dungeon, they only had him for like 5 minutes, but he already looks like he's been down there for weeks. He's so grubby and, he just looks so horrible. I thought,
well, see him like a bird in 5 minutes, just dirtying his clothes.
Yeah. They've just been going at him with clods of dirt is what they've been doing. Something else I found intriguing is that I think it's in episode 2 where Marco is talking to his friend, his best friend, this invention where they use these cut glass things to look at the stars. Well, then by episode 4, we've got the Doctor using a full-on telescope. So I said, well, that was a quick development. we went from an idea to the finished thing in a flash. And I'm trying to think if there was anything else I noticed. Well, I'll just kind of let it go from there. But the story was basically boring. It was a repeat of so many things we've seen before. But it was lovely to look at. So there you are.
Uh-huh. Okay, thanks, Mary.
It was beautiful.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. I suppose we'd better look at... hang on, let's see if anybody said anything on the feed.
Hope we haven't lost you listeners.
Yeah.
Right, I don't think it's as controversial this week as
Lillian Robbins says, both Disney won't buy DC and Avengers is epic. And then John Davey says, I never had a silver zip suit. Lol. And then Ian Kirk has sent his script. Lauren Nick said, imagine John in a silver zip suit. Never happened. And then Laura Nick says, as a member of a cult, a twirly dance around the altar is pretty standard. And then Lillian Robbins says, I think it did happen. Going to have to research John Pertwee in back brackets. Where I got some feedback, mainly from the sort of question that Kirby posed. Laurie Nick says, Demnos, Demnos, Demnos. Alan T. Butcher says, sinking to new depths again.
This is my feedback request, not just a question.
Oh, shut up. And then Kirby Bartlett Sloan says, a closely studied new depth, I hope. Alan T. Butcher said, you noticed that too, did you? Lillian Robin, I'm actually going to be brief this week. Nice story. Great possessed acting by Liz. That's rather what I said. Tom's having a wonderful time being the Doctor. Wonderful costumes. All those men's legs. Good God. Wonderful set design. Great but distracting location. Quibbles. No face surprise. Saw it in the Three Doctors. Magic circle dancing plus infiltrating the circle by one of the main characters. Just saw it with the Sisterhood. After going on and on about not using a gun last time, the Doctor flat out murders all of the Cult of Demnos. Conclusion. Fun story. Not the greatest of the Hinchcliffe era. Not the worst. Solid B. And then Kirby posts some distracting location pictures.
I like that.
Rob Lansdowne, like this story, especially as it looks like Port Merion. And then Kirby goes on about a load of nonsense, so we won't talk about that. Laurie Nick says, costumes. And then she says, evil Facebook just ate my comments. Will repost later. Actually, eight lengthy comments twice. I'm so angry. Third time is the charm. I freaking love this one. Why? Italian Renaissance. Catacomb cultists. Mad astrologers. Gorgeous location. A masked ball. Dungeon torture. Fancy dress. Daring do. It's historical done as gothic horror. Salami sandwiches. And most importantly, men in tights. Phew. Jeff Waddle says, well, I remember this last time round, just like it yesterday. And Mary Britt Blitz Lang didn't like it much then, so I guess she likes it even less now.
That's what made me realize that I had seen it before, because I thought this was a new one I had never seen.
Last week that you hadn't seen it, yeah.
Lauren Nick says, sometimes wonders what sort of episode hits Mary's sweet spot. I'm glad she said something not rude then. Jeff Waddle said, Talons of Weng Chiang. Alan T. Butcher said, yes, Mary's never seen anything as good as that in all her puff. And then there's a little animated thing from Laurie. Philip W. Cerner, that's Dr. Phil, friend of the show, everybody. This was a story I researched a bunch because it was a favourite one of my older brother and I bonded over, who is also named Federico. By the way, who jousts in an amateur lunatist? It is a fabulous Dudley Simpson score for this one, and then he goes on about those. So, tell you what, right, listeners, later on in the episode, there will be a segment that Dr. Phil has sent us. It's quite long, so I'm not going to play it now. But it will be inserted into the show. That sounds a bit rude, actually, doesn't it?
Yeah, and he has such great segments about the music.
Yes.
I missed the podcast.
Yes, thank you for that one, Kirby. So thank you, Dr. Phil. And so somewhere soon, that particular piece will be inserted into the show as if by magic. Well, not by magic. He sat over by the door, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
okay. We have more feedback. Well, feedback. We got to Dr. Phil's actual feedback. Actually, I don't know if this is the one he's recorded new or the segment he sent me. I'm just going to click on it and see what happens.
See how long it is.
It's Pretty Big Bad Podcast. Hey, it's Dr. Phil here, just sending in some feedback while I'm traveling across time zones to perform in Southwest
Michigan. Watch out for that squirrel.
Sorry I can't join you on the show for Mascom and Gregor. It's a real family favorite. My older brother, who's also a Federico, we always call him Count Federico for that reason, is one of the interesting connections that my life has, Doctor Who and early music. So you'll hear about it elsewhere on the show, but I wanted to send in some thoughts on a little event we had in Plainfield, Illinois, called Fandom Fest, where four of the authors of the book, Red, White, Blue, did a presentation on their book, which traces the history of Doctor Who fandom in the United States. And I didn't know that the earliest broadcasts of Doctor Who in the United States were actually from Canada in 1965, some of the markets in northern New York actually got to see black and white Doctor Who. Some of the interesting things is that Pertwee, who did not seem to grab audiences in the early 70s, and it wasn't until PBS really began playing the Tom Baker stories that it took off here, and the earliest conventions emerged in the late 70s, early 80s. So anyway, worth definitely an interesting read, and I bought myself a copy, that's for certain. Anyway, looking forward to your thoughts on Mask of Mandragora, and the info I said it was not too long. Anyway, I hope you have a great time. Take care. Talk to you later.
Do you really think podcasting again? Oh, dear.
Sounds like it's crashed.
Podcasting and driving at the same time is a safe thing to do, Dr. Phil.
Hey, I did it last week.
Listeners, do not worry. I have my sound effects at hand. And I've got this one. So do not worry. Dr. Phil, no Dr. Phils were harmed during the production of this podcast. That's so fun doing that live on air. I used to drop those in while editing.
Right. You used to edit those in.
I just said that.
That was hysterical.
Grief. Right. Okay, and there's more from Dr. Phil later on in the show, as I alluded to earlier. Right, okay. I've got a little bit of audio coming soon. If I can just... Oh, sorry, Ian, that Debbie's response
to... I just received a message on Facebook Messenger.
Did you? Oh, dear.
Oh, dear. Is it a classic study message?
Hello, 20 Minute Map Podcast. This is Ian Kirk.
Hi, Ian.
The Mask of Mandragora by Louis Marx. They say there are places where the bat droppings are twice the height of a man.
Yay!
This is well done. The BBC always does historical drama as well. The doctor said he needed to hide his armour under his coat, but when he met Hieronymus, it was clearly seen. Hieronymus was well played as a crazy priest. Stuart Fell was good as a juggling acrobat. Sarah Jane got too hypnotised and do her possessed acting. Tom Baker was hamming it up. At the end, he was waving around a salami. Silly sausage. Bye for now.
See, the crowd's reaction to that just says it all, doesn't it? Right.
Thanks, Ian.
Right.
Thank you.
Later on in the show, we'll be having more of Kirby. Oh dear. That's a bit of a shame, isn't it? More Kirby. All right. No, maybe not. Right then. Got some feedback from... Oh dear. We got... what are you laughing at? It's not funny.
Of course it is.
I'm right. Crying, really. Sorry.
Yes. We got Debbie Melrose reading some feedback from Alan T. Butcher. Oh, yes.
Hey. The doctor causes a problem and solves it by killing a bunch of people, or let's party like it's 1499. Dear 20 Megabyters, The Mask of Mandragora is, of course, a closely studied expose of the political and doctrinal struggles during the Renaissance period and the concomitant clashes between progressive and conservative attitudes, which remain relevant today. The central clash between the progressive Prince Giuliano and the conservative Count Federico provides the core of the narrative. With the prince are the up-and-coming figures of learning from these protein-like...
You might have to pause that one.
Proto-enlightened magic.
No, we have the co-founder... The rather damp-looking co-founder of the show. Hello. Goodbye. Oh, don't let him out. He'll want to come back in again. Door. I'll do the door then. Carry on.
With the prince are the up-and-coming figures of learning from these proto-enlightened times and our TARDIS crew. With the counter, all the powers holding back their society, the church with an attached cult, all the superstitious non-fact-based ideas and control techniques left over from darker times, and the great intelligence reheated as the Mandragora helix. It is clear throughout that whilst the prince is naive, he is self-aware enough to realise he has a lot to learn to be a good leader, but his despotic uncle clearly thinks he is a complete count about which he is only slightly but significantly wrong. Ooh. It should be noted that while some might suggest this is just a bit of a rehash of the Abominable Snowman and the start of the Web of Fear, it must be said it lacks the atmosphere and the fur. And luckily, Mervyn Hazen and Henry Lincoln never noticed, as they would have sued the BBC like they did Dan Brown over the Da Vinci Code. We also learn that Lesterson originally eschewed science and worked as a high priest, helping to doom to a grisly massacre all of his fellow adherents of Demnos at the hands of the Doctor during the Renaissance period. Many years later, Lesterson listened to science and joined the Vulcan colony, which he later doomed to a grisly massacre at the hands of the Daleks. Also, Zen from The Liberator did a bit of work on the side as the official spokesman for the Mandragora Helix.
The what Helix?
Master Mandragora was quite a brave choice to lead off the 14th season. It is substantively as close to pure historical as Doctor Who gets in colour. The Mandragora element
Sorry?
I say it wrong every time, you know that.
Carry on.
Purely serves only to pep up some action and light shows, but the essential narrative is largely descriptive of its context rather than the alien force. Tom and his scarf are on top form. The supporting cast are largely very credible, though the soldiers let down their dialogue somewhat in between dancing with swords on the woods. It is perhaps one episode too short or too long, depending on whether you wanted more or less of the unnecessary eponymous Helix tosh. Yeah. Doctor Who lends a hand with silicon implants to transgendered person. Those are my thoughts. Alan T. Butcher.
Well, what can you say
Mandragora.
I bet Alan's used to hearing sounds like that at party conferences and stuff like that. So,
I'm not used to hearing sounds like that, and I get it right.
Well, get it right. You mean Mandragora?
Mandragora.
I might give Kirby a point back if Kirby can say Mandragora the way Debbie says it. Kirby?
Mandragora.
See, he learnt it the way
done.
I did.
Yes, well, I did.
Yeah, I learned that way until I heard it said on the show.
Yeah, well done. Right then.
I heard it on the show first, but then when I got the novelization, I shifted it in my head because I only saw the show once.
Congratulations, Kirby, for only seeing the show once. Right then, we've got some more stuff coming through on the live Facebook feed.
I've seen it
feed.
Many times since then.
Where do we get up to? We got up to Lily and Robin say, yay, Laurie. I think that's in reference to that. I think it could happen. Going to have to research John Pertwee. Hang on, the dog wants to come back in.
I've got how to pronounce Mandragora here, and they're probably saying it wrong.
Mandragora. Moving back to what I was saying. John Davey, that's friend of the show, John Davey, soon to be elevated to the higher status.
Mandragora.
Yeah, there you go.
Who said that? Who said that?
What was that?
YouTube said it.
Oh, did it? So even YouTube can get it right, Deb. Lillian Robin said, yeah, oh, done that bit. John Davies says, here's a rusty sweet. There's probably a picture in there somewhere, which I'm not going to click on just yet, because it's an audio presentation. Or is it an audio file? I'll do it anyway, shall I? I'm curious. Oh, there's a picture of John Davey in a costume from the 12th Doctor era, which is that one with the Viking, you know, the costume of the Viking thingy that Isabella wore on her head once.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I love that. Yeah.
Dr. Philip W. Cerner, friend of the show, said, lots of love from Southwest Michigan today. It says SW. I presume that means Southwest. It could mean sunny, windy Michigan.
He's from Illinois, so he must be in Michigan doing whatever it is he's doing.
And Lauren Nick said, Alan, will he mention Machiavelli? And then Ian Kirk said, Mandragora.
Mandragora, yeah.
Yeah, it's all going very well today, isn't it, Debbie?
Yeah.
Okay, it's now time for this week's edition of You Won't Get This One. If I can find the oh, there it is.
Don't worry, I won't.
Right then, Mary, who do you think is going to win this week, bearing in mind your astounding and rather large victory of last week?
Well, I'm going to pull a double blind on this one, and I'm going to say that I'm going to win it.
Woohoo! Yeah.
And I'm going to say that I'm going to lose it.
Okay, we'll do that like that, if you so wish. You can't do that! You cannot pick yourself to win and lose. I'm sorry, that's against the rules.
It's not allowed.
It's not allowed.
Oh, really?
No.
Really, we're not allowed?
Not allowed to pick yourself on both. So who's going to lose then, Mary?
Well, I'm going to say, no, well, I'm going to change things. I'm going to say that I'm going to lose.
Good Lord.
And I'm going to say that Debbie's going to win.
Okay. It'd be interesting to see if the original choice of you winning and Debbie losing would have panned out. Anyway, Kirby, who do you think? Win.
First, I have a question first.
No, go.
Debbie, how many times have you seen it?
Twice.
Five?
Twice.
Oh.
Twice.
And how many notes have you made?
None.
I'm still going to say Debbie will win.
Okay, who's going to lose?
Do you have to ask?
Okay, well, it backfired last week. Debbie, who do you think is going to win?
I'm going to go with Mary.
Right. Yeah, see, I've thrown you all off now.
And who do you think's going to lose then?
Me.
Okay.
I wasn't paying much attention.
No, well, you've all got some sort of excuse. Right, everybody's got a joker each. And there's a new little twist this week. Now, if I actually say the phrase, you won't get this one, and you actually answer the question correctly, then you get double points. I might not say it throughout the story, or throughout the quiz, but if I do, and you answer it correctly, not on the second question, only on the first, on the second question is, yeah, so you got two goes at it, not the first. But you know what I mean when it actually happens. Right then, so first question goes to Mary. Oh, by the way, the scores are in last place with minus 2 points, Debbie, and the lead with no points each, it's Mary and Kirby. Right then, Mary. What is the first TARDIS? Thank you. What is the first TARDIS room that Sarah looks in?
I know.
Oh, my gosh. I'll use my joker, the boot cupboard.
That's straight into the lead.
We've just put a kettle on in the background, sorry.
That's all right. Should get you to bring me a cup of tea over. Kirby.
Master.
What does the doctor find on a chair in the secondary control room?
I know.
I'm gonna say joker. The third doctor's clothes.
And Debbie.
Yes.
What are the last backward letters of the alphabet that Sarah says before the doctor interrupts her?
F-E-D, I think.
All right.
Very well played.
I should have joked
that. Yeah, she should have joked it. Yes, you should. So no points in the bonus box. We move straight on. Mary.
Yes.
What is What is the doctor's observation when he steps out into the Mandragora helix?
Bigger than my boot cupboard
is the correct answer. Kirby.
Master.
How long does Giuliano have to live? Or Giuliano, or if I spelled it right.
Giuliano, let me think which one he is.
It's Giuliano, isn't it? Well, that would be the Duke, wouldn't it?
He's the Duke? He's the young Duke?
Yes, how
two
long?
Days.
Got there in the end. Debbie.
Yes.
How many sitting peasants does the doctor ask if they have been seen Sarah before he is captured by Captain Rossini? So how many sitting peasants were there?
Sod it, Joker, five. Oh, dear.
There's plenty of other questions you could have saved the Joker for. Go on then, Kirby.
Four.
Because that was a joker question, Kirby gets 2 points for that.
Oh,
there's 4 points.
I didn't know that worked that way.
Four points in the bonus spot. That was your question. So 4 points in the bonus spot then. For this question, what does the doctor produce as documents?
That twirly rattling thing.
Yeah, that'll do.
I'll let him
off because nobody else said anything, but we'll let him off on that one. Right, so the current scores in last place with
Does that have a name?
It's a rattle.
It's a football rattle.
A football rattle.
Yes. In last, a soccer rattle.
Grief.
Football rattle. In last place with 0 points, it's Debbie. In second place with 6 points, it's Mary. And then the lead with 12 points it's Kirby. And they, interesting to note that nobody has picked Kirby for any of the winning or losing bets this week. Just saying. Right, Mary's question.
Because I did so poorly last time.
Never mind. Mary, where was Sarah found by the followers of Demnos?
I know.
Where she was found?
Yes.
In the Orange Grove.
Not according to the script, it wasn't. Debbie?
On the slopes of the Hill of Sorrow.
Oh, well done. Yeah, well done indeed, yes. Right, Kirby.
Master?
Where is there no gold for the captain if the Doctor is right about the end of the world?
For some weird reason, right there where he is, San Martino.
Well done, Kirby.
It doesn't make any sense.
Tough. Debbie.
Yep.
What does it signify when Venus is in opposition to Saturn and a great shadow passes over the moon, according to the Doctor?
Oh, my God. Something about the moon being made of cheese.
No, look.
Cock crowing 3 or 4 times before dawn and 12 hens saying...
Oh, that's near enough.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's quite a ding. I'm going to do another one for that. Oh, did not. What's the bell? What's the matter with me?
No,
I need
notes.
A new bell.
I don't have notes.
She's reading from something.
I'm not reading.
Right, there's 1 point in the bonus pot.
It's a well-used expression, the 12 addled eggs.
Yes, thank you for that, Debbie. 1 point. You're turning into Kirby, you are. 1 point
okay,
in the bonus pot.
And this time we say, I know, instead of...
Yes, okay.
It out. Okay.
When will Sarah's hour of glory come?
I know.
Go on then, Kirby.
When the moon rises over the southern obelisk.
It's the correct answer. 1 point to Kirby. Points system is, so far, in last place, 3 points, Debbie. Second place, 6 points, Mary. In the lead, 15 points, Kirby. Next question goes to Mary.
Mm-hmm.
How does the Doctor escape beheading?
Well, he takes off his scarf and he uses it to trip up the executioner.
What excuse does he use to take off his scarf?
Oh, because he wants to look his best.
Yay!
Kirby.
Master?
What's the name of the guard who wanted to go down to the cult of Demnos? Oh dear. Squeaky door.
Oh dear. What's on second?
Beg your pardon?
What's on second?
What's on second? What do
I
mean?
Don't know.
Oh! Okay, anybody know?
No.
I'm sorry, I missed the question. I was letting my cat out.
Okay, Mary, for you.
No, he was on fire.
Oh, very good. What's the name of the guard who wanted to go down to the cult of Demnos?
Oh, was it Rossini?
Nope.
Oh.
It was Giovanni. And I should have said you won't get this one because none of you would have got it.
none of us did.
No, right. So whose question was that? I've lost where it was now.
I think it was mine.
Right, so therefore the next question goes to Debbie.
Yes?
What does Hieronymus command when the Doctor rescues Sarah?
Seize them? I remember that bit.
Hey, good. 2 points in the bonus pot for this question. What does the guard tell Giuliano that he thinks killed the men? You won't get this one.
I think I know.
Go on then.
I think I know too.
Fire demon.
Oh, blast. Damn.
But although he's blue, so I'm not quite sure how that's attributed
it
to
doesn't
Bernie.
Matter, but in last place with 8 points, it's Mary. In second place with 9 points is Debbie. In the lead with 15 points, it's Kirby. Next question goes to Mary.
Mm-hmm.
What is the prince's full title? Okay, you won't get this one.
What, you mean the Duke?
I know.
He's Giuliano, Duke of San Martino.
Don't! Mary. I'm not going to do that anymore. Which rulers accepted Giuliano's invitation? Sorry, start that again. Which rulers accepted Giuliano's invitation? 1 point for each, I believe, on this one. Edward
How
Hux.
Many are there?
I'm not telling you.
Oh, poof.
Who's gone very quiet again?
So is this Kirby's question?
No, it's yours.
It's your question, Mary.
Oh, but I answered the last one.
Is that the last question?
Okay, then it's Kirby's question then.
I thought the last one was a...
No, it wasn't, no. It was a Mary question. This is your question. Which rulers accepted Giuliano's invitation?
I know... I can remember the King of Naples. The Duke of Padua. I think the Duke of Milan. I don't remember any others.
Three points for Kirby. Signora of Florence.
And I know that there was... The Doge was involved, because that's one of my favourite words in the whole world, is Doge.
Okay, and that'll do for that. So there you go, that's basically everybody, so well done. Debbie.
Yes.
Right. What does Count Federico call Giuliano for arranging the celebration of his accession? You won't get this one.
I think I know.
Oh, no.
You're probably right. No idea.
Okay, 2 points going to the bonus part. And Kirby?
Arrogant puppy.
Oop, missed a ding. 2 points to Kirby, sadly.
This is a great story as far as things like that. Okay. With all the insults and stuff.
2 points in the bonus part.
Be
quiet.
Sorry if you can hear Isla snoring.
I can't.
She's snoring way upstairs.
Can't hear her snoring. Right. 2 points in the bonus pot for this question.
Wait, what? We just had a bonus, didn't we?
No. God's sake.
Oh, okay.
Losing patience. Right then, what put me down does Count Federico say to his men when several of them fail to kill Giuliano? Deer's gone very quiet.
You're going to say we won't get this one?
No, I'm not going to say that, because if there's a point, you're not going to get it, are you?
Apparently not.
Does he call them dogs or something?
Dogs or something, did he say? No.
Would there be doges?
No. The answer is craven gutted curs.
There you go, that's a dog.
Yeah, cur is a dog.
Silly. Right then, Mayor, although the scores. Last place, 10 points, Debbie. Second place, 13 points, Mary. In the lead with 20 points, Kirby. Next question goes to Mary.
Jeez.
Who was the finest swordsman the Doctor ever saw?
Captain of the bodyguards to Cleopatra.
Yay!
Good enough for me. Kirby.
Master.
If Giuliano has gone down to the Warren, what will he be harder to find than, according to Count Federico?
Oh yes, I love this one. A flea in a beggar's robes.
Debbie's question. Who is Leonardo da Vinci's patron?
Whose question is this?
Debbie.
I know the answer.
Oh, I'm probably going to get it wrong. Duke of Milan?
You're a right smart arse, aren't you?
Of course not. You get it right every time.
Smarty pun.
I was thinking Florence, though, because
you were thinking
clever
Florence.
Clever.
Yes. 2 points in the bonus pot.
Renaissance is one of my favourites.
Okay, never mind that. Right. 2 points in the bonus pot for this question. When Giuliano asks the Doctor how his uncle died, what is the Doctor's response? Everybody's voomed.
I think you can stop.
Well, can I stop it now? Everybody's given up, have they? Okay, so therefore... Yes, the answer was... Let's say Hieronymus gave him a blank look.
Oh, yes!
Now, that was a bonus pot question, wasn't it? So still 2 points in the bonus pot. Moving back round, I'm not going to do a score update. Well, yes, I am. Last place, 12, Debbie. Second place, 15, Mary. In the lead, 22, Kirby. Next question goes to Mary.
Okie dokie.
What name does the Doctor give for a medieval sextant?
Oh,
Don't know. I'll have to pass it on.
I know.
Okay. Apparently, Kirby knows.
Astrolabe.
As if it's blatantly obvious the way he says it. You should have known that, Mary. Right, Kirby, your question.
Master.
What system does the Doctor have to convert to?
The Copernican system.
Debbie.
Yes.
How many brethren does Hieronymus request to take with him?
10.
Didn't make any notes. She's doing this off air. That's amazing.
Yeah, no, no.
Yeah. Right.
She's just like, oh, yeah,
she's just a machine. She's a Doctor Who quiz machine.
She's just a memory.
That's why I said she's
going to
win.
I've always had a memory for things like this. You'd think really? It would be easier at school or something, but no, it's always TV shows and like Blackadder and Red Dwarf.
why aren't you doing better than I am this time?
I don't really pay much attention to this.
No,
one,
clearly not. Right, 3 points in the bonus pot.
And I didn't do notes, so
be quiet. Be 3 points in the bonus pot for this question.
What?
That's going to sound good on the podcast. Me saying blop 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 blop, isn't it? Right. It's this question, which is, what is the court jester's final act?
Do we even see the final act?
Well, we see the last thing he does, but yes. Basically, the last thing he does before we don't see him again.
This is the bonus pot question.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I think I know.
Go on,
breathe
then.
Fire.
Pardon?
Breathe fire.
Good enough. I've got my thing of swallowing fire. There's as much as I think.
He puts fire out in his mouth, yeah.
Right. Oh, I put the wrong amount of score in there, sorry. Okay, right.
Because he does something else after that, but we don't get to see it because we just hear the crowd.
Everyone's chittering, aren't they? And they
That's
go,
hey! Right.
Yeah.
Current scores are, with 3 questions left, in last place with 15 points, Mary. In second place with 17 points, it's Debbie. And in the lead with 25 points, it's Kirby.
Oh,
next question goes to Mary. How many steps lead up to the sacrificial stone, Mary?
I will hazard a guess of 4.
You will be hazarding an incorrect guess of 4. All right. Kirby. Oh, sorry, anybody else? Sorry, want to have a go at that?
2.
2 is... incorrect. The answer was 3. 3. No points. Nobody gets that one. Right then, Kirby.
Master.
Where do I have my phone? I'm going to put my phone over here because I'm worried about it interfering with the signal.
Oh, says, go Mary, go Mary, go Mary.
Go Mary.
Right, yeah, sorry. Kirby. Can you hear me?
Master.
Right. What,
yes.
What wouldn't the Doctor say no to?
It was going to be one of my quotes, a salami sandwich.
It was my quote.
Yes. Last question. This is for Debbie. Mm-hmm. Who directed The Mask of Mandragora?
Rodney Bennett.
Jeez.
Correct. So, before we have a further tote-up of the score... I'm sorry, the dog just snored. That'd be Stardown. In last place with 15 points, it's Mary. In second place with 19 points, it's Debbie. And in the lead with 27 points, it's Kirby. But, oh dear, I don't think any of the scores are going to change apart from...
Nobody.
Mary predicted Debbie to win.
Oh dear.
Yes. And she's predicted herself to be in last place, which is not a bad thing altogether, is it? Right. Kirby predicted Debbie to win. And predicted Mary to be in last place. Debbie predicted Mary to win. And herself to be in last place. So, the final adjustments of the scores are, in last place with 19 points, it's Debbie. In second place with 30 points, it's Mary. And the winner this week with 54 points, it's Kirby.
A wave of energy has been released, Count. It's part of the Mandragora helix. It could do untold damage. And I must take it back to the stars. Please listen, please. I realize that must sound very strange to you. Let me put it this way. A ball of heavenly fire has come down to Earth. It could consume everything in its path. It could destroy the world.
Do you tell the future?
Sometimes.
Can you tell mine?
No.
Why not?
Because you don't have a future unless you listen to me.
Dr. Phil again with another installment of Adventures in Time, Space, and Music. In this segment, we'll be looking at the music of Doctor's composer Dudley Simpson, as well as the use of period stock music in Doctor Who. Here, we will examine Serial 4M, Story 86, The Mask of Mandragora, a four-part story originally broadcast between the 4th and 25th of September 1976 on BBC One. Musically, a great product of Philip Hinchcliffe and Robert Holmes's era, Dudley Simpson composed one of his most iconic, lush, and dramatic scores in The Mask of Mandragora. According to BBC paperwork, Dudley Simpson composed 8 minutes and 9 seconds in Episode 1 of Mandragora, 1 minute and 50 in Episode 2, 8 minutes and 9 seconds in Episode 3, and 8 minutes and 49 seconds in Episode 4. Other music appearing in The Mask of Mandragora will be mentioned later when I deal with the period stock music. One of the greatest strengths of Dudley Simpson's score to Mandragora is the clear delineation between earthly elements, here represented by acoustic instruments, as well as the otherworldly, represented by the electronic synthesizer elements in the score. In interviews, Simpson often describes this as his method of separating the two concepts. Never has it been more effective and indeed apparent as in this story. The oft-stated criticism, mostly from 1980s producer John Nathan Turner, about the sameness of Simpson's music can't be leveled at The Mask of Mandragora, one of the most timbrally diverse scores from his run as composer on Doctor Who. By this point, Dudley Simpson's theme for the Fourth Doctor is being used in full swing here, being found in several variations throughout the score. While the most fully formed statement comes at the end of Episode 4, as the Doctor and Sarah bid farewell to Duke Giuliano, here's an example in triple meter evocative of the dance music that appears later as stock music in Episode 4. Among his acoustic forces, Dudley Simpson uses wind instruments, including stalwarts such as the clarinet and bass clarinet, but more importantly, the oboe is used to great effect in The Mask of Mandragora, sounding similar to its reedier period counterpart, the shawm. Brass instruments also appearing include the trumpet, horn, and bass trombone, the low brass being used to create a great sense of action and menace, being played muted and unmuted in this score. Listen for the dramatic horn calls during the chase and fight sequences. Percussion instruments also appear in great number in this score, including the snare, various drums, cymbals, bass drum, and timpani, as well as mallet percussion such as marimba and vibraphone. Simpson's skills as an orchestrator use many of these instruments, often in combination with electronics, to create many interesting orchestral colors. The orchestral bell is used to represent the tolling bell as the Doctor is led to his execution at the conclusion of Episode 1. Avoiding the use of period instruments for the most part during his incidental music for Mask of Mandragora, Simpson does include the harpsichord, albeit one that is much bigger than the keyboards used in the late 15th century. To be fair, it only appears in very small amounts, adding a subtle amount of flavor that only adds and not detracts from the overall story. While Simpson separates the acoustic and synthetic textures when necessary, one excellent thing he succeeds in doing is using the synthesizers behind the acoustic instruments to often thicken the textures in places, demonstrating that he is a master of making a small ensemble sound large, colorful, and interesting. One of the best representative examples of the difference between electronic and acoustic soundscapes in the story can best be drawn with two examples from Episode 1. After the Doctor and Sarah come across the old wooden control room, the TARDIS is pulled into the influence of the Mandragora Helix. Here we have a highly syncopated section scored with contrasting fanfares against an expansive melody performed by Simpson on the Electronic Music Studio's VCS3 synthesizer, accompanied by horns and percussion. The synthetic textures in The Mask of Mandragora are reminiscent of the bleak musical soundscapes Dudley Simpson created for the Series 12 story, Serial 4C, Story 76, The Ark in Space. The musical variety in this single story is quite staggering, really. Contrasting the music accompanying the Mandragora Helix in Episode 1 and demonstrating Simpson's astute creative talent as a composer of action music, this next example is the horse chase sequence in which the Doctor attempts to escape from Count Federico's men in Episode 1. The opening of the scene, as you may have noticed, features a percussion instrument known as the ratchet, also referred to as a noisemaker, which has a gear wheel and a stiff board mounted to a handle which can be easily rotated. The spinning momentum causes the board to click against the gear wheel, creating the clicking noise. Moving on to the stock music used in The Mask of Mandragora, specifically importance of historically informed performance. Early in Episode 1, it is established that young Giuliano's father, the Duke, has been assassinated. Accompanying this scene to great solemnity is responsorial chant. As this recording is not accounted for in the story's paperwork, it's hard to ascertain where the recording came from. Nonetheless, the responsorial chant that appears in the scene is often referred to as Gregorian chant, the central tradition of Western plain chant. Pope Gregory I, who sat as the Bishop of Rome from the year 590 to 604, Common Era, is traditionally credited for codifying chant across all of Western Christendom, assigning specific chants to certain celebrations during the liturgical year. In the late Middle Ages, the chant became the cantus firmus, or fixed voice, in early polyphony. In music, polyphony is a texture consisting of two or more independent melodic voices, as opposed to music with one voice, that's monophony, or music with one dominant melodic voice accompanied by chords, also referred to as homophony. While the origins in Western church traditions are unknown, early treatises such as the Musica Incendris and Schola Incendris, both dating from circa 900, are usually considered the oldest extant written examples of polyphony, while the Winchester Troper from around the year 1000 is the oldest example of notated polyphony for chant performance, although the notation does not indicate precise pitch levels or durations. The importance of polyphony to this scene from Mask of Mandragora is that by the Renaissance you would have had musical passages alternating between single chant and polyphony, as can be heard in this scene from the story.
He was a good man, Giuliano, a just and noble ruler.
Hieronymus, you foretold my father's death. How?
Everything is foretold by the stars.
I am just a humble astrologer. I only interpret their meaning.
But the exact day, the very hour, it's not possible.
When Mars comes into conjunction with Saturn in the seventh layer in the house of the Ram, and the moon is full grown, death comes to great ones. So it is decreed.
I don't believe it.
Many do not believe it. But the decrees of fate will be obeyed. We have no choice.
The mask was a form of festive courtly entertainment which flourished in 16th and early 17th century Europe, though it was developed earlier in Italy, in forms including the intermedio as well as the public one, the pageant. This fact is important as masks, as used in the story title and within the story, didn't exist in the 15th century, although the tradition itself goes back to medieval Burgundy. These musical entertainments often combined pastoral settings, mythological fable, often derived from antiquity, then Christian sources and ethical debates. Masks often incorporated political and social allegory. In Italy, Catherine de' Medici's court festivals were often overtly political, spectacular entertainments of her day, although the intermezzi of the Medici court in Florence rivaled them. Regarding the stock music used in Episode 4, in addition to Dudley Simpson's score, other musical examples appear accompanying action in The Mask of Mandragora. According to the BBC paperwork, The Mask of Mandragora uses several tracks from Terpsichore dance music of the Renaissance and early Baroque. These recordings were performed by Conrad Rusnik on lute, Vladimir Ivanov on percussion, with the members of the Ulsamer Collegium under the direction of Josef Ulsamer, as released on LP by Archive Music, catalog number 2533111. These dances were recorded at the Colosseum in Nuremberg, Germany in 1971, and the Würzburg Conservatory, Germany in 1973. Among the dance music recordings used during The Mask include 55 seconds of the Basse Danse La Brosse as published by Pierre Attagnon, 32 seconds of Brawl de Champagne by Claude Gervais, and 1 minute and 25 seconds of an anonymous Estampita Comacimiento de Guay. Pierre Attagnon, composer of Basse Danse La Brosse, was born during the last decade of the 15th century and died around 1551 or 1552. Attagnon was considered to be the first large-scale publisher of single-impression movable type for music printing, thus making it possible to print faster and cheaper than predecessors such as Ottavino Petrucci, whose Odhecaton was the first musical collection using movable typeface in 1501. Claude Gervais, composing the Brawl de Champagne, was associate of Attagnon, whose career flourished during the mid-16th century. The reason why this is important is that, out of these works, the Basse Danse La Brosse by Pierre Attagnon and Claude Gervais' Brawl de Champagne were published in the early 16th century in France decades after The Mask of Mandragora is set. The estampite, or the estampi, was a product of the 15th century, and therefore fits best into the cultural fabric of the story. While this is a mild criticism of the story, scholarship and research on early music is literally unrecognizable from when this album was produced, let alone how performers in the historically informed performance movement would perform these pieces today. As 1970s Doctor Who is a time capsule of the era it was produced in, so were these recordings, existing as significant recordings during a more than a century-old movement to rediscover and perform Baroque and pre-Baroque musical literature. As music of this period was not prescriptive regarding instrumentation, in performance the ensemble could be rather fluid, incorporating bowed strings, wind, brass, lutes, etc. Later centuries would see greater output of specifically instrumental music. There are very important concepts to understand here about Renaissance music. Improvisation was a central feature in the performance of this literature, often for the form of melodic ornamentation, often referred to as performing divisions. Transcriptions of vocal music for instrumental performance were numerous, as was the use of instruments in performing vocal music. Unlike later literature that audiences are more familiar with, dissonance and resolution were dealt with very differently. Much contrapuntal music began to appear for instruments such as the keyboards and lutes. While the violin family emerged from Italy during the 1470s, viols, a family of bowed guitars, had already emerged as a popular family of bowed instruments in Spain some 70 years earlier. Like lutes, recorders, and many various instrument families, instruments often were played in consorts, such as a consort of viols, lutes, recorders, etc. The instrumental forms of the works used during the masque scenes themselves include an anonymous Estampita Commecimento di Goi. An estampita in Italian, or estampi in the French, was a medieval dance and compositional form popular in the 13th and 14th centuries. Surprised that I've actually performed this estampita in concert, the Ulsheimer Collegium performance utilizes two instruments that are staples of medieval literature, the viel, a medieval fiddle, and the hurdy-gurdy, a sort of stringed bagpipe. The hurdy-gurdy produces the sound by a rosin-cranked-turned wheel that rubs against the strings, functioning like a bow. Melodic parts are played on a keyboard mechanism which presses tangents, small wedges of wood, against one or more strings to change their pitch. The hurdy-gurdy was popular in Europe from the Middle Ages and is still being performed today as parts of many oral musical traditions across Europe and around the world. As the other pieces in the masque appear later, Claude Gervais' Brawl de Champagne features solo sham, lute, tenor viol, and percussion. A brawl is a 16th century French dance style which moves mainly from side to side and is performed by couples in either a line or a circle. This piece, which is very short form, from which the pavin is later derived. The most iconic piece of music used in Mandragora is Etagnon's Basse Danse La Brosse. A basse danse, or low dance, was among the most popular court dances during the 15th and 16th centuries. The word basse describes the nature of the dance, in which partners move quietly and gracefully in a slow gliding or walking motion without leaving the floor, contrasting with livelier dances in which both feet left the floor in jumps or leaps. The latter half of the basse dance consisted occasionally of accordion due to their contrasting tempi and were often danced alongside the pavin and the galliard, which is a slow and fast dance pair, as well as the allemande and the courant, also being performed in pairs. While again, Attignon's Basse Danse La Brosse does not specify instrumentation consistent with most of the works of this period, the Ulsheimer Collegium here uses the instrumentation of crumhorn, sackbut, lute, bowed viol, and drum. Many of these instruments appear in many sizes corresponding to the various vocal ranges, soprano, alto, tenor, bass, and great bass, and that's where the consort groupings are derived from. The crumhorn is an instrument whose name literally means curved horn. It has a limited range and is a double reed instrument, as is the sham, an ancestor of the modern oboe. Unlike the sham, the double reed is mounted inside a wind cap, contributing to its softer buzzing timbre. Other double reed instruments in the period, in addition to the sham, include the rauschpfeife, the racket, and the dulcian, a predecessor to the modern bassoon. The instrument referred to here as the sackbut is the early trombone. The trombone, as a matter of technological innovation, hasn't really changed in technological design since the Renaissance, incorporating a slide which lengthens or shortens the length of pipe that is played through. That's where the pitch systems are derived on a sackbut and later the trombone. The lute, one of the most prominent solo instruments in the early modern era, is derived originally in the Middle Ages from the Middle Eastern oud, and unlike the oud, was often found played with frets. Now, in the Middle Ages, the lute was performed using a plectrum. This changes in the 16th and 17th centuries, where the plectrum is replaced by using the right hand and multiple fingers of the right hand to pluck the strings. This would allow, like on keyboard instruments such as the organ, for the lute to play polyphony, multiple lines at the same time. The viols, a family of bowed guitars, originated in Spain in the early 1400s, and, like all the instruments mentioned, occurred in many different sizes. Also, like the lute, the viols were fretted, making them bowed guitars, as I said before, and played with an underhand bowing style. While used extensively in Renaissance music, the solo literature for the viol does not really begin to develop, at least idiomatically, until the 17th century. Regarding the music from The Masque of Mandragora, while master tapes for Dudley Simpson's score do not exist for a separate release of the score, the music used in the masque scene itself, however, is. A digitally remastered version of the Ulsamer Collegium's Terpsichore, Renaissance and Early Baroque dance music, was released in 1985 by Deutsche Grammophon Archive Records, hence catalog number 415-2942. The original 91-minute 40-second duration of the LP is here reduced to 65 minutes and 45 seconds, omitting many of the Renaissance items. Deutsche Grammophon remedied this years later with the Panorama release Dances of the Renaissance, catalog number 469244, which can be found at many retailers and including many of the tracks submitted from this original re-release.
Hello there, this is Colin Baker, and you are listening to the 20 Megabyte Doctor Who podcast. And doesn't make... I'll do it again.
Right, back to the Facebook feed. John Davey, friend of the show, very kindly corrected my forgetting of the monster that he was, you know, he's demonstrating the costume of as the Maya. Right, everybody? You should have got that, really. Doctor Who fans, for goodness sake. Especially Kirby, who's a very pedantic Doctor Who fan.
I didn't see the picture.
Well, you should have looked then. And I did describe it really, really well. A Shielders episode, wasn't it? And I said that Isabella tried the...
Yeah, I remember the picture of Isabella wearing the mask.
Mm. I should actually link John to that picture. I'll try and remember to do that so he could probably get some amusement out of it. I got a video of that somewhere as well, at the Doctor Who exhibition. You went to that, didn't you, Deb?
I did indeed.
Mm. And then Laurenick says, go Mary, go Mary, go Mary. I think Mary seems to have a bit of a fan club going on there.
Damn, I appreciate it. I do.
Yes. I did get a tweet come through from my friends at the Isle of Wight Comic Con. Some more guests, I think, have been announced, and I don't know what they are.
Wow.
So I'm just going to have a quick look.
We're getting quite a few now.
Well, we've already had quite a few. These are extra guests, aren't they? Trouble is, I can't find the tweet that is referring to the extra guest. Deb, help! Help!
I'm looking. My internet is so lousy at the moment, I can't even get Facebook up.
That's what she said.
Laughing off.
John Davey and Sylvester McCoy are going along. John Davey and Alistair Pearson are our guests, although they won't be they won't actually be in the Doctor Who zone. I'd be very surprised if they were, but they are our guests. Because they are guests that I've arranged, whereas Sylvester McCoy is a guest that I advised to be included.
I'm so excited to meet everybody. It's going to be great.
But hopefully we might get a couple of them to visit the Doctor Who zone during the proceedings. Yes.
I noticed that Alistair Pearson was a guest at the convention that just ended in Crawley.
Oh yes, he likes going to conventions.
There were pictures online from somebody.
Okay, well, that's good.
One of the staggerers.
One of the staggerers. Oh, good. Okay, right. So, whowon.co.uk is one of our
is that
longest.
Shut
up. Our longest running.
I have to say that.
No, you don't. Our longest running sponsors, and they've been sponsoring us right at the back almost since day one when Isabella was about 3 years old. She's now nearly 12. So that's nine years. Oh, good grief! Yes.
That's my longest running joke too.
It's not a joke, Kirby. It's a blooming appalling, isn't it, everybody?
I found the tweet, and it says, when you realise there's 6 more guests to announce for Island Con in the next 2 weeks.
Oh, that's exciting, everybody. Watch this space. Okay, whowon.co.uk has latest products that you can buy now. That's a Doctor Who magazine special 49 with a new logo on the front cover as well. We're talking about the film that we all went to see last night. I forgot to mention that a certain character of it was played by Karen Gillan, who, if you may remember, used to be in Doctor Who a while back, and now is a bit of a Hollywood star. Ironic, because it was predicted that Matt Smith was going to be the big Hollywood star out of that particular collection of cast, and Karen, rather sexy Gillan, surprise, surprise, is the one that the Hollywood casters liked better. But she is rather nice, isn't she? I'd love to meet her, you know.
Oh, this is the only one of those films you've seen, right?
Yes.
Okay, because she's been in two others as the same character.
Well, I'm sorry about that, Kirby. I'm just saying. Right then, also from
she
Who...
She the big deal when she shaved her head.
Yeah, all right, thank you. Also, audio...
I want to shave mine.
Shut up. Audio Annual 2, as I mentioned last week, First, Doctor Adventures 1, which is an audio CD, and Doctor Who Magazine 524. We're talking about Target books coming back. Coming soon, that's on pre-order. Bearing in mind, my birthday, listeners, is in less than 2 weeks' time. Yeah. And if you want me to send you my address for such things as presents... Was that some break wind there?
No, what? I laughed. I'm sorry.
Because I'd like to remind you all that my birthday coincides with the birth of the show. Thank you very much.
I was about to say that.
Thank you. Although the show's birthday is the 13th of May and my birthday is the 12th. Like I say, if anybody wants me to PM my address, obviously, for the collection of presents.
And how many years has the show been on now?
Oh, I don't know. As I tried to tell you, Isabella was 3 when we started. That's how I work it out. She's now nearly 12. So I would say it was about 8 years ago. So, yeah, wasn't it 2010 we started? I don't know. We have to look back. It's on the website somewhere. That's a long time, anyway. Too long. Well, it's been for me. I've been doing all the work. Alien Amongst Us 3, already available for pre-order. It's a Torchwood story. Churchill Years 2 is a big Finnish story. Then, of course, the Day of the Doctor novel, the Target novel, which, if you like books and that, it's got to be worth buying, isn't it, Deb? You like your old books.
The
Day of the Doctor is a particularly good story as a TV story, so I would imagine the book version would be even more interesting. So that's your task, Deb. Buy that book, read it, tell us what it's like. Right. Death of Captain Jack, another Torchwood story, and Heliax Rift, which is a Fifth Doctor Big Finish CD. Isn't it lovely? You can still think getting things on CD. Actually, talking about CD, when I was going through my cupboard of goodies, but while we were clearing out to try and fit my oldest daughter back in the house, found loads of interesting bits and bobs. Some old Doctor Who VHS tapes, which I had to sling because they'd gone mouldy, although I did keep the Tube of the Cybermen because obviously it was one of Alistair's covers. But also, I found... I've deviated and forgot what I was going to say now. Oh, yeah, I found some audio tapes. The original Live Aid tapes that I recorded off the radio. So I must now try and invest in an audio tape player so I can actually back these up into a digital format. So I just thought I'd say, I thought that's quite interesting, that, but obviously you don't think so. You've gone really, really quiet. Right, Lure of the Nomad. I'll tell you what, talking about a friend of the show, John Davey, he's met and seen Karen Gillan on several occasions, the lucky... Anyway, he's a good friend of the show. Rose is also a book by Russell T. Davis, so which you can buy as a Target novel. I'm looking forward to it, actually, even though I don't read these Target books. I have read Target books. The only one I specifically remember reading was The Planet of the Spiders. That was a really, really good one. So I know they're fantastic, but I never would have time to read them. But buy them anyway. That's whoone.co.uk. Lavazzi.co.uk are purveyors of the finest Fourth Doctor scarves in existence, apart from the ones that were actually worn by Tom Baker in the series, but we can't have everything. But I'm sure there are some people that own such things. So, Doctor Who fans, if you want to have to wear something that makes you blatantly, obviously, a Doctor Who fan, whether you like the Fourth Doctor or not, the Fourth Doctor scarf is the thing, isn't it, Debbie? You haven't got one yet, have you?
Not yet.
Come on, then. Come on, get your finger out.
Unique one.
Yeah. Mary, have you got one?
Yes, I do, actually.
You're a good girl, Mary.
Well, I do have one, but it's a copy. It's not a proper one, you know.
Yeah, but we're trying to advertise...
I wore it to the festival.
We're trying to advertise Lavazzi here.
I know.
I have one.
What did you say, Kirby?
He's got one.
You don't want it? Okay, there you go.
I have one.
Oh, sorry. Did it not sound like he doesn't want it?
If you don't want it.
But I say, if you're a fan of Doctor Who, there's a load of really good cosplay things and just casual wear stuff that you can get from Lavazzi, along with Star Trek goodies, specifically lovely umbrellas and scarves, and just normal knitwear and fashion, along with Sherlock and a few other bits and bobs.
I'm going to be wearing it next week.
Are you?
Got to commit you next week.
Is that right?
Who are you going to wear?
Yeah, but don't forget, there's a thing called a 20 megabyte Doctor Who podcast T-shirt, which you would also have to wear, wouldn't you? Don't forget to take a recording device with you, Kirby, and record some interesting stuff for the show, for a change, because it's all very well doing all this live stuff, which we can't do on that occasion. So because we can't do the live stuff, what's that mean you've got to do?
record stuff.
Good boy. You might even get some bonus points for that. Well done. Okay.
Very tentatively said that.
I'll see what I can do.
That's not the answer. Mary says that, and we never get anything back.
I'm going to remind Louise Jameson about the surprise interview.
You can do that, because I've already had an email conversation with Louise about the same thing recently. So you could do that if you so wish. It wouldn't hurt.
What did you say to her? Or did she remember you or about it? Or
I can tell you, actually. I can actually talk about the conversation I had with Louise Jameson. That's Louise Jameson, friend of the show, everybody. If I can find the appropriate email. Jameson. Oh, good Lord. It's on here somewhere. I think I'm looking at the right email. Oh, maybe it's not. Maybe it's in the other one. Bear with, this is live trying to find an email.
Well, I can tell you how...
Oh, here it is.
How I'm going to be dressed when I meet her for a picture. Mm. I'm going to be carrying I'm creating a copy of the nucleus of the swarm, and I will have feathers around my eyes because I will have been absorbed by the swarm. Contact will have been made.
Okay, so I sent to her, we will be celebrating our 400th episode later this year. Would be honored if you would consider Skyping or phoning into the show as part of our celebration, as you did for our 100th episode 6 years ago. I think it was more than 6 years ago, actually. Oh, no, it wasn't 6 years ago. I was right, yes. To which Louise said, oh, God, where's the answer?
Go away, who is this?
Oh, good grief, I can't find the answer. Where's it? It's done everything in a funny order.
The answer's 42.
Yeah. Email me nearer the time, re-podcast.
Lovely.
Okay. So if you speak to her, that would be quite cool.
Okay.
You don't have to.
Not that we're badgering you or anything, ma'am, yes. But...
And record something.
I thought you'd remind her about how surprised I was when you're just introducing us around and you introduced her and
she won't remember it. I've already spoken to her about it at the Doctor Who celebration, to which I got my picture taken with her. It's on my mantelpiece, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yes, I spoke to her about that. I can't remember what her response was, actually, but I don't think she remembered it that well. Right, so Doctor Who news. There isn't much, to be fair. There's talk of the Doctor Who magazine with Matt Smith and Jenna Coleman on the cover. Matt Smith riding motorbike. And there's Lethbridge Stewart 50th anniversary novels. That's going back to the 22nd of April. Laughing Gnome is the one that they've got highlighted. And vinyl releases of for the record store only of Tomb of the Cybermen and City of Death. So there's really not a lot of Doctor Who news at the moment, I'm afraid. So that's why I left it to last. And of course, they're currently filming it.
When is the next season supposed to start?
In the autumn, I believe. Can't say that's true, but yeah. So that's about it for the show. But we need to talk about when we're next recording.
We already knew that.
Yes, yeah.
I'm just rarefying this for you lot. What did you say?
13th of May.
13th of May, yes, indeed. That's the day in which I'll be celebrating my birthday, because I'm working on the 11th and 12th. And the 13th, I would have done a few celebrations, hopefully, here. So by the time we get to the evening, it'll all be out of my system. And I would have opened all the presents and stuff I would have got from the listeners. And what are you laughing at? We've got the kindest listeners in the world, you know. And of course, meaning that most of our listeners come from the United States, so it takes a couple of weeks for the parcels to come through. So, like I say, it's 20mb.feedback@gmail.com. That's 20mb.feedback@gmail.com. Don't say that email address on air very often. But of course, you want me to, or you can just PM me on Facebook and I'll just send you my address. Anyway, all right, Laurie Nick said, send your mailing address, I'll send the show a new bell. Well, it needs to be a better bell than one just about to show to the listeners, which is this Disney thing. It's a bit hit and miss, and you can actually get some really good service bells, which are a lot bigger than that, and actually when you press them, they always go ding. This one sometimes goes ding, depending on how well you hit it, but the service bells will go ding, or however ding. You hit it. It's the proper dinger would be good, but that's a present for the podcast, not for me. Never mind.
I'm going to get you one.
I beg your pardon. Oh, wouldn't she love it? She just said done. I love Laurie. Magic, do you love Laurie? Magic, look, he's doing his garm face for Laurie. So, by the time we next record, I'll be 53. You lot will hopefully be joining me for such festivities to celebrate the podcast's 8th birthday. I forgot that wrong, someone let me know. 8th birthday. So, until then, thank you for watching Mask of Mandragora. Next week, we're going to be looking at Next time, we'll look at the Fan of Ear. Which is, of course, Elizabeth Slater's swan song in Doctor Who for many years, because she does eventually return.
And I've seen this one.
As I've pointed out many times,
yes,
it's my introduction story to Doctor Who. I would not be a Doctor Who fan if it weren't for the Hand of Fear.
Sorry, do say something, Kirby. And Laurie Nix then said, oh, you'll get a gift too. She's such a charming. Well, lovely with these people. They're promising to send me gifts when they know full well I'm not going to get anything back from me, apart from the podcast, of course, which spends a lot of time and effort and stress doing and putting up with Kirby, of course. Right then, so until the 13th of May, thank you for watching, listening to the show. Watch and listen to Hand of Fear. Goodbye.
Goodbye, Fancy Pants.
Megabyte Doctor Who podcast is an APV Services production, sponsored by whowon.co.uk and lavazi.co.uk. We are a proud member of the Doctor Who Podcast Alliance. Doctor Who is a trademark of the British Broadcasting Corporation. No copyright infringement intended.